All right, we'll get started. I'll apologize up front. We'll be doing a lot of ad-libbing here and a lot of reading. Not my preferred method, but that's where we are. Thank you. Habakkuk is dealing with two different things that are pretty prevalent in life. And it's not necessarily kind of the main theme of the book, but we've really been skirting around the issue the whole time. And being that we're spending so much time with the book, then you know, sooner or later we're going to start dealing with those issues a little bit more head on. And two of those issues are doubt that he begins to have, and then also the question of suffering. This isn't going to be an end-all be-all about suffering. That's just a little bit too deep for one night, but we are going to deal with it and talk about it a little bit. I'm going to read to you that the very end of the book, something that Habakkuk says, and this is kind of an interesting introduction to these things that he's dealing with. This is in Habakkuk 3. I'll start in 17. I'll go 18 and 19 as well. For though the fig tree shall not flourish, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no food. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Jehovah the Lord is my strength, and he maketh my feet like hinds' feet, and will make me to walk upon my high places. It might be a little difficult for us to understand the magnitude of that because, you know, we're not farmers. We're not relying on the fruit maybe of the field, and the olive trees, and those kind of things. He's saying that no matter what happens with all calamity, losing everything that you have and everything that you hold dear and everything that we say we don't hold dear, but we depend upon it all day long, all week long, like it is the only thing that we hold dear. And when you lose it all, he says, nevertheless, I will glorify God. You know, it's interesting when you begin to talk about suffering, people say, well, let's turn to Job. Job teaches us how to suffer. No, he does not. That's not why that book was written. It shows you an incredible example of a man who did suffer. But you know what the whole theme of Job is? It's what Habakkuk comes with this conclusion. It's this solution right here. It's this, what Habakkuk feels in the very end and proclaims. And that is that when Satan had gone to Job and he said, well, sure, he's worshiping you. You're doing all these things for him. You touch him. You take it out of his life. And then you're going to have a different person. And God said, well, just bring it on then. The purpose of Job is exactly what Habakkuk ends up concluding with. And that is that you don't do it because of what you get out of it. You don't do it because Jehovah God is going to bless you. You do it because of who Jehovah God is. That he is deserving of glorification and worship, no matter what happens with us. And when we begin to start talking about suffering, if we don't keep that foremost in our mind, then you know what? We're just pagans. That's what the pagans did. That's why they passed their children through the fire. That's why they did the things they did. It wasn't to glorify any particular God, but it was to get that God on their side. That's why they hired the interesting people that would come along and be like the magicians and the magi and all of this. They were individuals that supposedly had a little dialogue going, and it wasn't like a prophet, but it was like, hey, you know, get him on our side, right? And that's the way Balaam was in the Old Testament, right? Well, get Jehovah on our side. And that's what paganism is all about. And so they would bow down or do whatever they had to do or give certain things. They would set, you know, food up in front of the gods or whatever continually, but it was to get the good favor of that God in their lives. You know what? We're not pagans. That's not what this is about. If we don't understand that no matter what happens in this life, this nation, our family, or whatever, that God deserves glorification and worship because who he is, and that's the whole purpose of Job. It's like, no. You sit around and think and philosophize all you want about why this is happening, who's doing what, how come this is, you know, in the end, he was like, no, the whole thing, it's about who Jehovah is, regardless of what our life is here. And so when we start talking about suffering, You're not going to have the answers for all the atheists. They're coming from a completely different position than you are. They're absolutely coming from just a completely different position. We think we may have some answers. We may, kind of put some thought into it, but you're not going to satisfy the person that says, hey, look, unless God's doing these great things for me and life's a lot better, I'm just not believing in Him. Okay. That's right. Honest struggles for honest hearts. 2 Chronicles 16:9. If I had a memory verse for tonight, it would be that passage. For the eyes of Jehovah run to and fro throughout all the earth to show Himself strong in behalf of those whose heart is perfect before Him. We're going to see that several times in this lesson. Where the eyes of Jehovah run to and fro, searching for those people who can stand up amidst all the chaos, all the trauma, without the question, without all the doubts, without losing all the faith, because He wants to show Himself strong in your behalf. And if that's one thing that the Old Testament teaches us, is not only that God's desiring that, but the propensity of people to just continually look somewhere else for their answers, somewhere else for their strength. And we think they're short-lived, short-sighted. I mean, we can't even hardly imagine going, well, your grandfather did these things. He was blessed. Now here you are doing this. And we're going to find out, 2 Chronicles 16:9, who He's actually talking to and what are their circumstances. We'll find that out later tonight. Habakkuk was troubled by what he saw and the lack of justice. In this, he is no different than us today. Why does moral relativism reign? We see it consistently growing and consistently getting stronger. Our world is starting to make no sense whatsoever. Why does a company like Twitter justify leaving up a feed showing the actual sexual assault of a child and defending it, but at the same time cancel the account of the President of the United States or others who disagree with their orthodoxy, deeming them dangerous? Why do we hear about two pathetic women prostituting themselves by acting out a pornographic scene on primetime TV during the Grammy Awards, then hear the nation's political power and communications media berate those on the conservative right because they complain that their sensibilities were wirebrushed? Why is it that Sports Illustrated can feature a man that has been mutilated by a surgeon in its annual female swimsuit issue and be celebrated by all those that hold political power and therefore social directional control in this country, while we are told that those who are offended have psychological issues stemming from bigotry and hatred and intolerance? Why are those NFL players that show any revolting reaction to open homosexual affection sent to re-education counseling, while the left continues to hold up their anti-bully and tolerance campaign as the end-all be-all of moral values? Why is it that a woman that shoots herself in the belly while being 9 months pregnant, leading to the death of her child, after it is delivered by emergency C-section, is found not guilty of any crime, while if a man were to kill a game animal out of season, he would go to jail? Why is it that a woman who dumped her 10-minute fresh newborn baby in a dumpster after home delivery is not spending time behind bars as a murderer, but instead is counseled by the state on her disturbing behavior? And yet at the same time, we're told that the killing clinics have had no negative effects on the value of life in our society. How can that be that if you walk down the street in New York and display some perverse sexual behavior, you're thought of as courageous and you should be celebrated? Well, on that same street, if you walk down the sidewalk without a mask, you'll be publicly called out, bullied, and harassed as a menace to society. Why is it that the U.S. military and DOD have special required educational classes on extremism, which is billed as the greatest danger to our ranks and country? Well, at the same time, these same military mentors have repeatedly told their students that the burning, looting, and killing an occupation of U.S. citizens by over 1 million Marxist puppets over the summer was for racial injustice and posed no national threat. Why is it that the Bible and Christian prayer is anathema in the public arena of the U.S. and outlawed in schools, and bumper stickers that show Christian slogans or emblems were banned from cars in California state parking lots and schools? But the children are required to take introduction to Islam classes and instructed to take Islamic names for 2 weeks while they learn about Muhammad the prophet so that they will learn not to hate. Why is it that our universities tout academic freedom and tolerance when it comes to any philosophy or any political view under the sun and insist on teaching unscientific evolution and yet bar Christian religious views, ridicule creation science as superstitious, and encourage students to shout down and bully conservative visitors and guest speakers into leaving campus while maintaining that the hate and bullying has to stop? Why is it that a girl can be filmed on the national news holding up a sign that says, "Say no to fascism and say no to hate," in the street of Baltimore with fires burning and local businesses around her, while an unconscious Asian reporter behind her is being kicked in the head by a mostly peaceful demonstration against injustice? Just as the Israelites of God had turned from him and their justice was perverted, Habakkuk saw this and they were going to be judged by the Babylonians, and God said, "Oh, their judgment will be from themselves." This is what we call the shadow enemy soldier, what John Kackelman has deemed the shadow enemy soldier, which was doubt. Doubt is Satan's tool. Proverbs 24 and 10 says, "If you are slack in the day of distress, your strength is limited." Jeremiah 8, 18 says, "My sorrow is beyond healing. My heart is faint within me." I believe one of the best stories of this is probably Elijah himself. As we turn to 1 Kings and 18, we had talked about him before on Mount Carmel making that great standoff. What a great challenge. 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah. And there he is on the big showdown. He says, if God is him, you know, Jehovah God, then worship him. But if your God, Baal, is God, then let's worship him. But let's not go limping between both sides. And he has this incredible showdown. Now, you have to imagine what this is like to think that after they've danced around, screamed and howled, cut themselves and tore down the altar that he'd put up for Jehovah God, what the reaction is when the fire finally comes down and consumes that wet, dripping altar. Because at that point, even these pagans, says when they saw it, they fell on their faces. Isn't that interesting? Their dancing stopped. Jehovah, he is God. Jehovah, he is God. In the Hebrew, that's twice. That's just a complete emphatic emphasis. Jehovah, he is God. And Elijah said to them, "Take the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. Obviously, the pacifists of today would have a hard time being an Old Testament prophet. How bold and how courageous was Elijah to go through all of those prophets, to have the showdown, to pray and call fire down from heaven, to have even these individuals that had just been worshiping Baal fall on their faces and say, "Jehovah is God, Jehovah, he is God." But then we read in 1 Kings 19, and Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life. That's one of the most amazing passages in all Scripture. I don't know how powerful you can imagine being or thinking or feeling if you're standing up against 850 prophets of a pagan god and then have hacked them all and killed them with the sword, had an entire population fall down to your God on their faces, admitting that Jehovah is God, with one small prayer, God let them know that you are God and that I'm your servant, and the fire comes down and the world in Israel changes. And then from the threat of this woman, he packs up and begins to run. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Palestine and the geography, but if you look at that, where he begins to run and where he ends up, it's a long journey. He goes so far and finds a juniper tree and figures, that's it, I'm just going to give up. It's all over now, but I've done my thing. I'm done fighting. This is too much for me. I could take on the 850 prophets of Baal. I could take on an entire population that's been led astray, but this one wicked woman, she threatens me. I'm done. And then the angel says, get up. You're not finished. You want to run? How about a place called Horeb? You got a couple of days to get there. That's way far away before he's finished running. John the Baptist is another one. Could you imagine anybody stronger? Anybody that gained more attention in the first century? Somebody that multitudes were going out just because of the power of his message. Of course, he's an inspired prophet of God, but he's doing no miracle. He's out there dressed like a mountain man. He's got some message that they haven't heard before. And then when the Pharisees and all the leaders show up, all these people with the phylacteries in the robe, all the people that when they show up, everybody kind of parts the ways because they know they're not supposed to touch them. And then he says, ye offspring of vipers, who warned you to come here? You bring fruits worthy of repentance. The axe is lying at the root. He was strong. He was very strong. And yet there's a time and a place when he sits in a dungeon and he begins to wonder and he says, maybe I've missed it. I don't know how long he was there, but it wasn't that long. And he's already wondering because doubt, Satan's tool, begins to enter his mind. And it doesn't matter who you are, what we are as Christians, doubt is Satan's tool. It's his ally, not ours. Habakkuk is struggling with doubt. He had heard God's answer to a question, and now he doubted God's justice and the outcome. Remember last week we found out that he remembered he was the creator, he was the holy one, and Jehovah God was his rock. But now he was troubled with the answer. Isaiah 31, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many. And are in horsemen because they are very strong, but they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Jehovah. Isaiah is saying these kings that are so great, he's begged them. He's told them everything he can tell them, and yet they're turning to other people, worldly allies. Hezekiah can't find a greater king. Cannot in the Old Testament. He was upright before Jehovah all the days of his life. He is an individual that showed incredible strength. He showed incredible faith. And yet, you know, when Sargon takes Samaria, he's one of the strongest, greatest kings that Assyria ever had. Sargon goes marching up into the steppe country of Eurasia with 50,000 Assyrians. They were trained soldiers. They were going to go against these armies of these Afghanistans, you know, the individuals we talked about, the horse soldiers that were hiding and wouldn't come out from under the trees and the rocks. And the greatest army the world has ever seen disappears. Sargon never comes home. Now, it's hard to imagine what that's like now because it took us so long to get human remains out of Vietnam. But in those days, you would cash it all in to get the king's body home, period. You just didn't leave the king behind. You didn't leave one of your gods behind. If you carried it into battle, you just cashed it all in. And if somebody took it and wiped out the army, you were coming back for it. Sargon disappears from history and they never find him. The entire army disappears without a trace. Sennacherib, we read a lot about him in the Bible, but if you'll notice the little sentences and stuff, he sends those others to Jerusalem. He sends others to Judah. Sennacherib never leaves home. Isn't that interesting? He's supposed to be out there leading his people, but there's no way. He remembers Daddy. Daddy just disappeared. He's sticking pretty close to Nineveh. When Hezekiah sees this as one of the most faithful servants of God, one of the most faithful kings, he knows Jehovah God. He's relied on him before. He's going to rely on him again. And when Sennacherib starts running around and he's got his soldiers threatening him, he goes and starts cutting the gold off of Jehovah's temple doors. Isn't that, when you read that, don't you think there's something wrong? Don't you just kind of stop and think, wait a minute, what's he doing? What is he doing? Well, see, he's living a life like we are. He doesn't know the end of the story. He doesn't know what's going to come afterwards. He can't open up his Bible and go, hey, this all turns out pretty good for me. He doesn't know anything like that. He's just in the middle of life. He looks around, he sees these threats. He's like, well, I'd rather just rely on God, but that doesn't seem like it's going so well. I'm going to strip the temple. I'm going to take all the silver out of my house, all the silver out of the temple, and I'm going to try to pay this guy off and get rid of him. And don't you imagine maybe God had a hand in the fact that maybe Sennacherib was just wasn't going for it. Nah, I think I'll stick around and harass you. No, since you're so, you know, you're in such a hurry to get rid of me and pay me off, maybe I'll just stick around, make your life miserable. Even to the point where they're going to speak Hebrew to the people on the walls and so that everybody gets a little afraid and understands. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Jehovah and the treasures in the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple, from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Syria, trying to buy him off. You know, doubt reduces God's army to a capitulating people negotiating terms of surrender. One of the best examples we have is Asa. 2 Chronicles chapter 16. Asa is a man that knows God. He's a man that's been faithful in some things. And then Baasha, king of Israel, says, well, you know what? You guys aren't like us anymore. We don't like you. You don't like us. We used to be brethren, but we're kind of like shooting cousins now. We don't really like each other. So Baasha comes down and he starts building Ramah. And when he does that, of course, there's the prophets. There's God. His eyes are to and fro throughout all the earth, right? To show himself strong to those whose heart is right before him. But no, Asa's going to go and he's going to start sending the same kind of presence. He's going to strip the temple of gold. He's going to strip his house of silver and he's going to send it up and he's going to say, Ben-Hadad of Syria, you and I, we're now brothers in arms. Break your alliance with the northern kingdom of Israel. And so that's exactly what happens. And in verse 7, at that time, Hanina the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said unto him, because thou hast relied on the king of Syria, and hast not relied on Jehovah thy God, therefore is the host of the king of Syria escaped out of thy hand. He goes on to remind him of the other people that he had conquered for him, that how he had protected Judah. And then he tells him, for the eyes of Jehovah run to and fro throughout all the earth to show himself strong to those whose heart is perfect before him. Now you know the rest of the story. That was to King Asa. And then here, Hanina, a prophet from God, is sent to kind of straighten him out. Maybe wake him up. Give him the message. You know, you missed this the first time. You've been foolish. But God's going to have mercy and grace on you, isn't he? What's part of mercy and grace? The word of God, isn't it? It's funny, we talk about the grace of God today. You don't hear people saying the grace of God is the words of God. But it has been throughout all history that these words of God, these saving words of God, are the grace of God in its final form. And he goes to him and he says, you know what? You've been foolish. What's Asa's reaction to that? He was wroth with the seer, put him in the prison house, for he was in a rage with him because of this thing. Now, the point is, when we talk about doubt, we talk about suffering, you're going to be going two ways. There's a choice on how you're going to handle that. There's a choice on the individual that's driven back towards God. There's the choice of a person that's driven away and says, I'm never going to darken the church building again. I'm not coming in. First, Asa had doubts, for Jehovah had helped him. After Jehovah had helped him, he allowed doubts to cloud his judgment. Secondly, he was sent a message by God, and notice his reaction. He was in a rage. He began to subjugate his own people. Was not humble. Lifted himself up, relied on self. Thirdly, God couldn't stand that any longer and had to send him a disease in his feet, I would imagine. We're told that he was diseased in his feet. And we're told that God was waiting to heal him. Isn't that something? God Almighty that spoke this world and universe into existence is just sitting right out there waiting to heal. But I'm going to call one of these soothsaying physicians over here. From our perspective, it sounds almost unbelievable. But remember, Asa's a man just like we are. He doesn't know the rest of the story. He's just dealing with what he's given. But he allowed his suffering from his diseased feet to drive him in a different direction and never turn towards God. Doubt makes one seek his own solutions and turn from God, our rock and our salvation. Suffering has different effects on different people. The conquest of shadow soldiers. The main complaint from Habakkuk. Why dost thou look with favor on those that deal treacherously? Job asked the same question. Why do those who know him not see his days? The question, why? First, it's not inconsistent with God's character to allow suffering because good comes from suffering. This is pretty difficult for us to understand. It's hard for us to try, well, even in raising our children. We say we want them to have it better than we had it, but that's not necessarily been a very good thing in America. The first census after World War II was the first census in the United States where we went from an agrarian society to metropolitan living in the metropolis, the cities, and things begin to change very drastically after that. You've seen the commercials about the Marines with a few good men. They wouldn't even begin to think of sending a Marine in battle if they hadn't already tested his mettle in the furnace of training. It's getting to a point now where we've forgotten those lessons. Out in the United States Air Force, there were this, for years you would go through this crucible of trying to build somebody's character up and their mettle and their endurance. When I was out there, we all got in trouble, and I had an individual lose his entire career after 17 years of great service to the United States because these officer trainees fresh off the campuses of our university lied to him about taking showers one morning. They just thought, well, if you don't get caught, it's really not wrong, right? I mean, that is the moral perspective of the modern day era. And so he wanted to teach them a lesson instead of kicking him out. He could have kicked him out. He could have said, oh, all right, sign this thing right here. Caught you lying, we're getting rid of all of you. But he didn't. He thought, no, you know what, I'll take care of you. I've been around long enough. So he took them out and started running them. Well, they missed breakfast. They missed breakfast. You ever missed a meal? They missed breakfast. When they said they had blisters, he said, step out, you don't have to run anymore. My knee is hurting, okay, step out, you don't have to run anymore. He'd give them water, let them rest up, all right, hit the track again. In the end, he had to go find a job in a library. It's an interesting thing what we think about hardship. How did God birth a nation out of a large family? He put them in what he said was the furnace of Egypt. It served a purpose. It served a purpose to keep them separated from the Egyptian influence as much as could be possible and still keep them together as a nation. There were so many things that he was doing, and yet they would not have been able to see that. All they were doing was crying out. Right? In fact, their cries weren't even to God, right? If you go back and read in Genesis, their cries are just, they're just crying out in pain. Somebody stop this. I can't stand this. This is overwhelming. And you can understand that. They're not crying out for God. It's just a cry. God still hears their cries. But they were going to go through the crucible anyway. Jesus talks about the chaff and the wheat. John the Baptist said his winnowing fork was in his hand. Because every little kernel of grain has a little husk on it and it's just useless. So you beat it up, scrub it around, throw it in the air, and you have to separate the two. Every piece of metal that comes out of ore is put into the fiery furnace. The most inspiring things that you'll hear in your life are individuals that have overcome suffering. You know, Kelly had a great aunt. She, when I first married into the family, I learned about her. And I got to meet Merle, her husband, who they were young, newlywed. Back then, you wouldn't wait to get married, right? You'd get married at 17, 18 years old. Within a year after getting married, now she had the same dreams everybody does. She had the same dreams of living this life, having children. And within 1 year, her husband was diagnosed with MS. Of course, they didn't know much about it back then, but it was very progressive. He was in a wheelchair in 2 years. So for almost 50 years, she would get up in the morning, she'd crank him out of bed, go over there, wheel that heavy load into a bathroom. Not the bathrooms that we have today, but a bathroom was built in the 1930s. She would wheel him in there and she would bathe him down. And then she'd bring him back out. And then she would set him up in a chair. Then she'd cook his breakfast and she'd put that in front of him. And then when somebody would come over to watch him, then she would clean herself up, take off and go work 8 hours. Then she'd come home. And then she'd start fixing supper, cleaning him up, put him to bed, getting to bed herself when she cleaned up the kitchen and the rest of the house. She only had about 50 years of that. Why is that inspiring to us? It's not inspiring to tell you a story about somebody that had no hardship, that was given everything that they wanted, and that every time they turned around, somebody bought it for them, and they just had no pain, there was no disease, there was no hardship in their marriage, their children were all perfect, all this was going on, and that's not inspiring at all, is it? Why is that? Why as humans can we detest suffering and begin to be doubtful and think about God in certain ways and maybe have our faith shaken? And yet, if you think about it, there's something about us. There's something about the world, the way God wired the world, that we find that inspiring. It's inspiring. It is well with my soul, written by a man that's, you know, on a ship at night going over the Atlantic to right where his wife and child had sunk and lost their lives and now inspired millions. There was a young English woman that was over at her in-law's house in a little village in England, and a storm blew in from the coast and began to snow very hard, and they tried to tell her to get home, get back to the other side and get to her little village, and she had a newborn baby, and so she packed it up and they started thinking, you know what, you ought to stay here. She says, no, I think I'll be fine. It was just a short distance. They said, no, you need to stay here. This is really blowing in a squall. And so they couldn't talk her into it. She felt like she needed to leave, and she did. And so she walks through this blizzard, and of course it begins to blow, and the snow is blowing. She can't see. She's blinded. Nobody's out. So the next morning, they realize she never did make it home. So they call dogs out, and they begin to search for her. This is the late 19th century. They finally found her in a snowbank, in a snowdrift, and She was naked and had taken off every stitch of clothes she had and wrapped the baby up, and she had dug a hole and put the baby down in the hole, and she laid her body on top of it as the snow and the ice built up on her back. And of course, she was dead and frozen. They expected the worst and suspected the worst, but yet when they finally lifted her body, the baby began to squirm and cry. It was hungry. That same child grew up to be the Prime Minister of England. When people sacrifice for the greater good, when people overcome hardship, when people go the extra distance, when they do things that are extraordinary, extraordinary already means that there's something there. There's a difficulty in life. And why would it be, and how could it be if there were no difficulty, no suffering? I could be wrong about this, but I suggest to you that instead of atheism saying, why is there suffering? I would suggest to you that if it was a perfect life, why would you need God? And why would you think there was a God? If there's suffering, many times we think about it in terms of sin or separation from God, the actions that people take. Could you imagine how confusing this world would be with no matter what you do, it turns out just as well as if you obeyed God? The Japanese Empire was just like the American Empire when it was going to war in the South Pacific. How confusing would that be to think that, well, either society, it just doesn't really matter. And yet when we drove up amphib aircraft to the island of Saipan, we were wading through all these civilian bodies floating there and women that had babies and babies that were dead, and they were having to push aside, and these individuals, these men had to have counseling because of what they were seeing in the water, and all these women and children had thrown themselves off these cliffs in Saipan because the Japanese had mirror image. They said, well, you know what? This is what we would do. If we came in and took Saipan, we would gut everybody. So they said, you know what? The Americans are going to gut you when they get here. You best just jump off the cliff. It'll be a lot easier for you. Those that didn't make it up to the cliff because they were too sick to get up there and jump, you know, throw their bodies off, they were absolutely in shock with the way they were treated and would go down for years saying, with the heartache they felt because they watched other family members that thought we were going to just maim them. And yet the societies were different, weren't they? Very different. And doesn't that help us to understand that the closer a people, an individual, a family, a society, a community, a nation, closer they are aligned to biblical Christian principles, it's different. It's very different. And if it weren't, well, wouldn't that be a faith tester to say, well, wait a minute, we're saying there's a God, but it really doesn't really make any difference which way we go here. It all works out the same. And yet we look around us and we see all the time the evidence of what happens when people leave God and change a worldview, and suffering begins to increase and the trauma surrounds us. I'm not saying it's a doubt maker. I think it's a faith builder. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.